Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 89.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1127, I will air some of the remarks delivered at different events held this past week while the Democratic National Convention was being held, all about Gaza, the support of the U.S. to the genocide in Gaza, the catastrophic situation there, and eyewitness accounts from doctors who volunteered in Gaza over the past few months. But before I do that, I'd like to ask for your support and contributions to KPFT, this unique commercial-free Houston's community station, because KPFT is currently in fund drive, and that is a great opportunity to upgrade your listenership to listener sponsor and become a member of the KPFT family. KPFT is mainly financed by listeners like you, and it does not rely on the corporate world to operate. So please give us a call right now at 713-526-5738 and make that tax-deductible contribution to support your community radio station. That's 713-526-5738. You can also make a pledge online at kpft.org. Join us in keeping the airwaves alive. Your support during this fund drive ensures that KPFT remains a vibrant hub of local voices and diverse perspectives, just like this program, Arab Voices, that has been on KPFT for over 22 years. Yes, we started in April 2002, coming to you weekly with over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from across the world. So it's crucial to continue your support to your community radio station, KPFT 90.1 FM. Every dollar you contribute goes directly towards sustaining independent journalism, empowering grassroots initiatives, and fostering a sense of belonging in our community. Together, we can make a difference through the power of community radio. 713-526-5738 is the number to call right now and support your community radio station. And again, you can do it online safely and securely at kpft.org. Arab Voices, if you're not familiar with it, is an award-winning independent radio talk show that aims at bringing the truth, facts, and realities to the wide and diverse range of listeners. It debunks many of the stereotypes, myths, and false information disseminated by certain media outlets, some politicians, and others. There is more information about Arab Voices and even a list of all guests that appeared on this program on our website, arabvoices.net. There is also an archive section online for listening on demand to any of the previous shows. So if you appreciate what this station has been doing, I ask you to support it and keep Arab Voices and other programs on the air. Please make that call and make a pledge of any amount, whether it's $60 or $360. Call 713-526-5738 or make a pledge online at kpft.org. Your support is greatly appreciated. As a listener-supported station, we rely on your generosity to continue providing commercial-free, thought-provoking programming. Your donation today is an investment in the future of accessible, inclusive media for everyone. With your help, we can amplify marginalized voices, promote civic engagement, and celebrate the rich tapestry of our community. Help us preserve the heartbeat of our community. Your donation is not just a gift, it's a statement that you value independent media, local storytelling, and the power of connection through the airwaves. If you enjoy the variety of shows this Houston's community station 90.1 FM KPFT brings you, but aren't yet a member, please join us right now and become a member. It's people just like you that make all this possible. Call now to pledge your support, 713-526-5738, or give online at kpft.org. Imagine a world where every voice is heard, every story matters, and every tune resonates. Your support makes this vision a reality on KPFT. Together, let's keep the spirit of community broadcasting alive. We are not just asking for donations. We are inviting you to be a part of something bigger. Your contribution fuels our mission to inform, educate, and entertain our community. Together, we are the voice of unity and diversity. 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Supporting KPFT isn't just about keeping the music alive, it's about preserving a space where ideas flourish, voices unite, and conversations thrive. Your donation today is an investment in the heartbeat of our community. 713-526-5738 is the number to call right now and pledge your support or make a donation online at kpft.org. Thank you very much. The Arab American Institute, AAI, organized special events throughout the past week in Chicago to make sure that those in Chicago for the Democratic National Convention know that Americans want the killing in Gaza to stop. Several panels were held, and I'm going to share with you now some of the remarks delivered at some of the panels. Let's begin with the remarks of Hani Al-Madhoun, Senior Director of Philanthropy at UNRWA USA and co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen, talking about UNRWA USA, the murder in Gaza of his brother and his family by American-supplied weapons to Israel, and the catastrophic situation in Gaza.
I'm going to start by talking about UNRWA USA for a minute. That's in my name, but then I'll just take the UNRWA USA hat and then talk on behalf of somebody who's dear to me. So UNRWA USA is the largest humanitarian actor inside UNRWA, is the largest humanitarian actor inside Gaza. I work for UNRWA USA, the American charity that supports the work. You all know, you've all seen the vilification of UNRWA, the humanitarian actor that literally is saving lives in the front line. You've seen the dehumanization of UNRWA staff. You've seen the 70% of the schools are destroyed. We could be here until 5 p.m. if we want to quote statistics, but this is just an example of how the Palestinians are being dehumanized. You've seen the whole world go crazy when, sadly, the tragic events of the World Central Kitchen were killed, Johnny and Peter, and the message the world sent was like, hey, their lives is more valuable than Ahmed and Aisha and the people, the 207 UNRWA staff that were killed. So that's part of that, you know, if they don't look like me, then I don't care about them. And sadly, the media plays to that narrative. We've done so many interviews talking about this incident when we were screaming at the time there was 130 or 140 UNRWA staff who were killed. And all of a sudden, you know, like, hey, like Johnny from Poland is definitely should not be killed, but the person at UNRWA who was driving the delivery of shipment or food, maybe they have something, you know, and that plays to the narrative. And I've seen this with my own eyes in December where there was a video, December 4th, I think, a video of the Israeli media were saying, hey, these are militants we're arresting in North Gaza. And literally, like at 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning, I look at this video, as all Palestinians know, we're all in Telegram and WhatsApp and all those groups, and I see my own brother, my brother Mahmoud. He's been like, and they're saying he's a fighter. This guy cannot run for a minute. He would call a cab if he has to go two blocks. He's not a fighter. But the media was running with it. On the flip side, we took the story and ran with it. I said, hey, this is my brother. He's not a fighter. And we were able to talk about it. And because we pushed back, NPR and even the ABC reporter in Tel Aviv called the army. He said, hey, this guy is not. Why are you saying? 20 hours later, they were released because, you know, we were able to identify somebody. Imagine if somebody who is like doesn't feel comfortable or doesn't want to push back. You know, they grab my other brother the next day. That's not the story. But to tell you, they were able to get away with this and spread lies and misinformation. The people they arrested, they're all our neighbors in Mashrua Beit Lahia. They're not the brightest kids. They're just hanging out with their families, and they arrested them, and they made them, you know, they want to say like, hey. And the media was like, hey, they're arresting militants, and they paraded my brother like an animal circus. So that sort of like plays in the dehumanization. So remember, agencies like UNRWA needs the support, not just the financial one, which is important. Literally, it's my job to make sure UNRWA has resources, and I work with Mara here, who spoke earlier. So the point is that it is easy to attack our organizations. Right now, if you pull your phone and say UNRWA, just Google UNRWA, and you will see an Israeli government website saying bad things. Israeli government, and Google is allowing this to happen. Can you imagine? Do any charity, do the World Food Program. They're doing good work. They're not being picked on. But UNRWA is being dehumanized for no good reason. And you know this has something to do with the right of return for the Palestine refugees. So continue to advocate and make sure that the next administration, inshallah, they will refund the agency, which became the law until March next year, that they would not fund it. And I'm here to report that a lot of American donors are stepping up to support this, despite the misinformation, despite the lies. Continue, please don't stop. This is literally, I just met with a gentleman here and he committed just a few blocks from here, a sixth gift figure for Gaza. And this is the biggest in his history. And he is just a nice Turkish American software developer who saw this. And, you know, he said, I cannot stand by. Literally, just before I came here and grabbed lunch, people care about this. So this is the point, you know, we're not alone. Rani is correct about allyship and the Rainbow Coalition. Now, the UNRWA USA part is done. So please, if you want to quote me now, just remember, I'm an American voter. I have rights to the degree this administration allows us to have rights. So I'm here on behalf of my brother, Majid. He was murdered on Black Friday last year by his American-made weapons, and he was killed with all his family. So this is where it got really personal really fast. This is not some number. This is my brother. He's a year younger than me, and they took him away from me. Uninvolved in anything, sleep with his wife and kids there, 5:15 a.m., some Israeli soldier killed him, his wife, his kids, six people. One bomb took 10 seconds. The bombs is the kind that sucks the oxygen from your lungs, so you die, but your body remains intact unless you get hit by the debris. Safa was collected and buried it twice because the first part, they recovered one half, they buried it, and then the next morning they went, dug up and found the other half and buried her. Before Safa was murdered by American weapons, her family, just 3 weeks prior, 17 family members, all her parents, her siblings, everybody was killed. And it was such a bad case in North Gaza where my brother, rest in peace, Majid, wasn't able to allow his wife to see the remains because the body bags, put them in a plastic bag, that's the situation. And that's sort of like you become like, okay, so what's the end game, you know? And on top of this, a few weeks later, when they killed my brother, they arrested my brother Mahmoud, abducted my brother Mahmoud. They have no authority to be there. And then a few weeks later, I see a video of my sister baking bread-like substance from animal feed. Animal feed, they grind it up, and she said it smells so bad, their cat wouldn't eat it. That was in late December, early January. And despite UNRWA's best work, access wasn't granted to the agency. So we had to really fend for ourselves. And it would come to see your own sister and your family being starved, you have to do something. So together with a lot of Americans who care about this, we started the Gaza Soup Kitchen, literally to cook to the neighborhoods. And it now became one of GoFundMe's most ever successful fundraising campaigns that reached $1.5 million ever just in GoFundMe. And this is to tell you, we just told the stories. I was telling my friend here that I never shared the donation link. I just tell the story and people go Google and find. And this is because people care. It's not one thing to go to a rally, please go to those, but to put your hard-earned dollars behind this, it allowed us to cook for families, literally our neighbors. We, my family in North Gaza, my family in Deir Balah, they eat from the same food they provide. Now, in Gaza, is the starvation? Yes, in man-made starvation in the north, correct. The only thing they have a lot of right now is flour, because UNRWA and the food program delivered. And now, this is not okay. Like, we know, we've documented this. We literally, my family went to Kamal Adwan Hospital, showed pictures and names of people, and still, some people in social media tell us this is fake. These people are Turkish actors. They question, like, I have full control of the story. I have this. The photographer is my friend. The kitchen is my brother. Nobody's lying. But somehow, I wake up in my LinkedIn, and people just yell and scream and say hurtful things. In fact, some people on Facebook, they say, a real comment I received, He said, thank you for telling Jewish-owned Facebook your location so we can bomb you. So a lot of those threats, they come, and they tell me, where do you live so we can bomb your family and all that. A lot of those things happen. My colleagues have seen worse. A friend of my colleague Nahid has been threatened by a man in Texas that he's going to kill him. So there is a lot of that. That's plays to the dehumanization of the Palestinians. At the end of the day, I want my family to be safe. I was meeting with the White House. I was meeting with amazing people. At the end in January, I figured we're just wasting time. This is not an administration that sees us. And unfortunately, you know, we continue to engage with anybody who would listen, but we need to end the dehumanization. We tell a lot of stories where we show relatable Palestinian kids. All of a sudden, it's not just a soup kitchen, it's a community place where people bring their roller skates to be taken pictures of, because that's the only evidence that they may have existed. So that's sort of like, and they love to see this in addition to the food we're bringing. I pray to God Almighty, whoever we pray to or don't pray to keep him safe. This is serious. 50 meters away this morning, and I've shared this with my boss, 50 meters away, a bomb in Deir al-Balah took out a dozen Palestinian family. And this is 50 meters away from my own nephews and nieces are scooping zucchini kusa today. So death is all around. In the north, they're being starved. My mom's health is deteriorating because of diet. My father is not able to do an eye surgery because there is, come on, how many doctors do you think Gaza has? This is how many professors? There is nobody to do a lot of this. Doctors are just doing things. Literally, an operation for the brain, they conducted in a flashlight, in a cell phone light. You think, you know, we're heroes and braves and resilience, but this is too much. This is 10 months. 10 months out of a can is not a diet. People, the skin diseases are real. This is the media moved on. They want to only talk about the election, and they do not want to, but people are still being killed. They're not starving. They're being starved. This is all man-made. This is not an earthquake.
That was Hani Al-Madhoun, Senior Director of Philanthropy at UNRWA USA and co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen. Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, a physician who volunteered in Gaza, spoke at the first ever panel on Palestinian rights at the Democratic National Convention. Let's listen to her testimony, which was recorded by Democracy Now!
For the past 10 months, we have witnessed civilian massacre after civilian massacre, school massacres where internally displaced people were sheltering, the flower massacre, massacres of people trying to collect water, massacres of people collecting aid at aid sites, massacre after civilian massacre, entire families exterminated in one single bomb, humanitarians, healthcare workers killed, and journalists killed in record numbers, pediatric amputations in children that are breaking records. Over 17,000 children who have lost one or both parents since October in Gaza. We have treated so many children who have lost their entire family that a term has been coined to describe these children. You've probably heard it, wounded child, no surviving family, WCNSF. This is a term that has been coined since October to describe this very frequent phenomenon that I personally witnessed more times than I can count while I was there. For children, I have held the hand of children who are taking their last gasps because their entire family was killed in the same attack and couldn't be there holding their hand and comforting them and could not bury them thereafter. For the children who I treated who were discharged, they were and survived, they face a Russian roulette of 100 ways that they will likely and potentially die when they leave the hospital due to the circumstances incompatible with life that have been architectured by this military assault. Direct bombing, starvation, dehydration, disease, alarming reports of the first cases of polio in Gaza right now. Polio is a potentially deadly disease that causes paralysis, including paralysis of the muscles needed to breathe. That has been eradicated for decades in that region. There's been a polio vaccination campaign that essentially has eradicated the disease from the majority of the world, and now we're seeing cases emerging in an area of the world that has a healthcare system that has been completely and entirely annihilated. I mentioned these wounded children with no surviving family. I'm going to give you two quick stories just so that you can humanize what I mean when I say this, because I know it's really hard to hear these numbers and think about individuals and what this means to them. I received a young boy into the emergency department during one of the mass casualties who had half of his face and neck blown off. Luckily, the organs that are vital for breathing and blood supply to the brain were preserved. They were visible, but preserved. And he was talking to us. He couldn't see himself, so he didn't know what he looked like at that point in time, and he kept asking for his sister. His sister was in the bed next to him. The majority of her body was burned beyond recognition. He didn't recognize that the girl in the bed next to him was his sister. His entire family, parents and the rest of his siblings, were killed in the same attack. That boy survived, and the next day I went to see him, a very young plastic surgeon, one of the few remaining plastic surgeons in Gaza, because the others have either been killed or have fled, understandably, had removed part of his chest and created a graft to cover those vital organs of the neck. He was lying in his bed and mumbling because it was so difficult to talk, and he kept saying, I got really close to him and he said, I wish I had died too. And I said, what? And he said, I think my entire family has gone to heaven. Or it's not my entire family. His exact words were something effective. Everybody I love is now in heaven. I don't want to be here anymore. That is one of so many stories. I'm so sorry, Leila, but I think people need to hear this. I'm giving you the story of one child. One of my healthcare worker colleagues, a young nurse, one of the most dedicated nurses I've ever met, was trying to evacuate a patient when Al Shifa Hospital was bombed from north to south. He carried that patient, was eventually called by Israeli forces, not by name, but by uniform. You, the person in scrubs, come here. He was subsequently detained for 53 days. He reported physical, sexual, and psychological torture while in detention and ultimately released because he had no crime. After he was released, he worked constantly because one, he was so dedicated, and two, he suffered from severe insomnia from the trauma of his detention. He was always in the resuscitation room of the emergency department, cleaning out sand from the eyes of people pulled from under the rubble, trying to comfort them. One day, overnight, he fell asleep holding the body of a dead child, still with the breathing tube in after they had failed to resuscitate the infant. Another day, I asked him to go home because he hadn't slept in so many hours, so he left the hospital. A couple hours later, I see him in the emergency department trying to resuscitate a man whose both legs and one arm had been blown off. I asked him what he was doing in the hospital. I thought you went home to rest. And he said, this is my sister's husband. They woke me up to tell me that the aid distribution site had been bombed and my sister's husband had gone there. So I went to find him and found him severely injured. So I helped him resuscitate this patient. His home has been destroyed. He's a young man, he's engaged, he's trying to get married. He had a whole life ahead of him and he was a very dedicated healthcare worker. I'm giving you two stories, a child and a healthcare worker, but these are representative of literally almost everybody I know in Gaza. I don't know a single healthcare worker who has not lost multiple members of their family. So, as the U.S. continues to fund this military campaign unconditionally and somewhat blindly, in stark contrast to documented realities on the ground, in stark contrast to the findings of the International Court of Justice of plausible genocide, and in stark contrast to the universal global condemnation of humanitarian and human rights organizations, we have no choice but to exert as much pressure as possible and use all the leverage we can to change direction, the direction that this country is taking.
That was Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, a physician who volunteered in Gaza, speaking at the first ever panel on Palestinian rights at the Democratic National Convention. Uncommitted voters, delegates, held a press briefing on the second day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and several doctors shared during that briefing what they witnessed while volunteering in Gaza. Let's listen to the remarks of Dr. Nabil Rana, a vascular surgeon from North Carolina.
My name is Nabil Rana. I'm a vascular surgeon from North Carolina. I'll keep this brief, but I can confirm every single thing that each of my colleagues has said. And to be honest, we're saying the same things and hearing the same things over and over. And that's all I can do is reiterate that. I'm not Arab. I'm not Palestinian. I went to Gaza as a human being and as a privileged American. And I saw all the pictures, all the videos that we all saw when we went. But just to, in the same tone of what Dr. Youssef said, when I arrived across the military border into Gaza, I was at a loss of words. There's nothing that can describe what you see and what's happening there and what has happened there. And there's no amount of pictures or videos or stories that will ever capture that. And my only hesitation even talking about it is that I'm not going to do justice to what's actually happening there. I don't have the words to describe it. We're trained as surgeons here in America with confidence and a bit of arrogance to know that anything that comes in the door as a physician, you can take care of it. And I have never felt so helpless and useless as I did over there. And let me unequivocally say, there is no humanitarian aid or relief happening in Gaza right now. No matter what we're told, no matter what we see in the news, on TV, no matter what you guys are told, there is none of that happening. And I can attest, when I went there, I was not allowed to take any medical supplies with me. People were turned away. Entire convoys were canceled. I couldn't take any more than a bag like this of medication just for myself. I couldn't take any equipment that I thought I might need or that they might need. And when I arrived there, there had been no aid coming in for weeks. There had been no supplies coming in for weeks. And this is not talking about the civilians' food and water. I'm talking about just the hospitals and medical care and relief. And so when I got there, we have almost nothing to work with. This is how the physicians have been working for 9 to 10 months. And so I was at a loss of, what is my role here? What can I actually do here? When you don't have the instruments and supplies that you need, how can you actually take care of people? And so there's nothing coming in. We were not allowed to take anything in. And so this facade of relief and aid, I need that to be clear, that I'm not telling you this from what I heard. I'm telling you this that I am a witness to that. And that is continuing to happen from people that I've talked to that are there now. In addition to that, the restriction on medical personnel is so severe now, only a handful of physicians and medical aid are actually allowed to enter every week. And many of those convoys are canceled. So there's not enough personnel there, there's not enough supplies, not enough equipment, and all of this is being restricted by Israel, no matter what we think we hear that, there's aid and relief going in. These people are suffering, and there's not much that we can actually do. Now, my role, like Dr. Youssef said, is I'm here as a witness, not from what I heard or secondhand information, but from what I saw. And what I saw, the atrocities, I can tell you graphic stories and details. You've heard these stories and details. It's happening every single day. It's not just the 3 weeks that I was there. It was happening for months before. It's happened since then, and it continues to happen today, this morning, tomorrow. It will continue to happen. These are innocent civilians being murdered and killed. Families are being destroyed. Every single person you talk to has a story that would devastate you. It would crush you to hear. And every single person has a story like that. And we get caught up in numbers, 40,000, this many, that many, 20 kids, and they're just numbers. But every single human being there is a human being like you and me, and every single person has been devastated beyond what I can even explain. And for me to try to explain it would do injustice to them. And the one thing I can tell you, most of the people there had so much gratitude when we arrived. And they asked you, what can we do for you? What can we do for you? How can we make you comfortable? I said, I'm here to help you. It's not the other way around. I'm just here. Tell me what I can do to help. And this is their mentality, to still host and still take care of you when they have nothing. I can attest to this. I can't tell you how many people tried to feed me when they had no food themselves. there was one older man I ran into in the hospital, and he was asking me directions to something. It was chaos everywhere in the hospital all the time. And I tried to explain to him, I don't speak Arabic. And he said, where are you from, in broken English? I said, I'm from the U.S. And his face just filled with pain. And he grabbed my hand, and he pulled me close to him. And he said, my house was destroyed. My family was killed by a missile that came from the U.S. And as an American, I was ashamed. I had nothing to say to him. I had no response. And all I could say is that there are still people in America who are fighting this. They're trying to stand up for you. They're speaking up for you. This is all I can promise you, that we'll keep doing that. He said, what are you doing here? I'm a physician. Are you working at the hospital? No, I just volunteered to come. The pain slowly eased, and he just resigned himself. And then he said thank you and gave me a hug. The gratitude for someone that just cares a little bit is so deep, and it's humbling, because these are people who are used to being neglected, forgotten, denied. And you've heard from everybody here, I can attest the same thing. The only thing anybody asked when you ask them, what can we do for you when we leave? Just tell everybody our story. They didn't ask for vengeance. They didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for that. All they said is, don't let anyone forget us, and just tell them what's happening here, what you saw. And that's why I'm here, because I feel helpless, but I'm only here because they asked me to tell their story. And besides the devastation to human lives, I can tell you that this is annihilation of an entire society. Besides the genocide, besides the massacres, we hear bombs like rumbling thunder all day long, that after a few days, you don't hear it anymore. You just become used to it. Until a week later, another person comes like, oh, what is that, bombs? Yeah, that happens all the time. And so one day I left the hospital in my 3 weeks and drove through Khan Yunis, and I actually saw what all this rumbling had done. This is not targeted strikes. This is calculated, sequential annihilation of an entire land. There is nowhere that you can go in the city where it's not leveled. Neighborhood by neighborhood by neighborhood, farmland, water plants, everything you can imagine is just leveled. And there's nowhere else to go. There's no safe camps. Nobody feels safe anywhere they go. The day I arrived, with my own eyes, I witnessed a missile strike in a safe camp in Mawasi, about 300 yards from where I was. People scattered, and after a while, they went back to see if their families were still alive. The medical students Dr. Yusuf was talking about, they come every day. The nurses, the doctors, they come to the hospital every single day, dressed like this, ready to work. And then you realize after a week, wait a second, these guys are wearing the same exact scrubs with the same stain on the pants, the same scarf, same shoes, socks, everything. And then you remember, you actually sit down and say, wait a second, every one of them is living in a tent. Every one of them has been displaced 6 or 7 times, and they still come to work every single day at the hospital to take care of people. And this medical student, there was one girl, 21 years old, her name is Dima. She was so, what we call a gunner over here. She would come to the OR, she would ask questions and this and that. Their schools are destroyed. They have no credits, they have no classes, this is a lost year for them if, God forbid, it doesn't go past that. And she would still come every day like every other student, just dedicated and trying to work, trying to learn, trying to live their life. She's just 2 years older than my own daughter, who's at UNC Chapel Hill. She's in class, studying, thinking about her degree, what she wants to do. And this girl I'm talking to, who's nearly my daughter's age, and Dr. Yusuf and I were encouraging her to say, yeah, you know, work hard, make sure you do well in your exams and this and that. She giggled and said, yeah, if I'm still alive. This is a kid over there who's no different than my kid over here. And this is their life every single day. They don't know what's going to happen that day. We're talking about ceasefire. I'm telling you, we're way, way too late for a ceasefire. This should have happened months and months ago. Should never got to this point. We're on the wrong side of history. And we're going to learn that one day. And right now, the only thing we can do is right now stop sending arms and funding, because this is on our hands as Americans. This is on our hands. And there's no question about it. That's the only thing that we can do right now. And so it has to stop. Thank you.
That was Dr. Nabil Rana, a vascular surgeon from North Carolina. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Shortly, I will air the remarks of Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine and the law and Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. But I'd like to remind you that KPFT, Houston's community station, is currently in fund drive, and because KPFT relies on your support to operate, I am asking you to please call us right now and make a tax-deductible contribution. During this membership drive, please make a gift in support of the wide variety of shows that matters more than ever on KPFT. Please give online at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738. Members are the single most important source of funding for KPFT 90.1 FM. Why don't you call right now to make your membership investment and become a part of that important source? 713-526-5738, or you can give online at kpft.org. And if you make your membership a sustaining one, you'll be supporting the station for years to come. 713-526-5738 or kpft.org. This program, Arab Voices, has been on KPFT for over 22 years, coming to you every week, covering various topics with over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from around the globe. I interview guests on the show, and I also attend events and lectures, record them, and air them. Several radio stations syndicate Arab Voices in different cities in the U.S. and even a couple of cities in Europe. So if you appreciate what this station has been doing, we ask you to support it and keep Arab Voices and other programs on the air. Please make that call and make a pledge of any amount, whether it's $60 or $360. Call 713-526-5738 or make a pledge online at kpft.org. Your support is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much. As I mentioned earlier, the Arab American Institute, AAI, organized special events throughout the past week in Chicago while the Democratic National Convention was being held. Several panels were held, and I am going to share now the remarks of Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking about why we don't hear about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine from U.S. policymakers and the law and Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. Let's listen in.
And I want to talk a bit about today a couple of things. I'm going to spend my time on a couple of things that I want to share. First, I want to address why is it that we don't hear much about the legal rules that are applicable to Israel's occupation of Palestine from U.S. policymakers? Where has the law gone? Why doesn't it feature more prominently in U.S. policy? Second, I want to look at what the law actually says about Israel-Palestine conflict resolution. The International Court of Justice, or the ICJ, the judicial arm of the UN, issued a landmark decision about the legal consequences of Israel's prolonged occupation in July. Many people, maybe a lot of you, haven't heard about what that court said. In January, it also ruled on the provisional measures that have to be taken in Gaza to prevent genocide. The case was brought by South Africa. So I'm going to talk about those two cases and what they say about the legal obligations that should be a part of U.S. policy, but that aren't. So first, where has the law gone? Why don't we hear much about the legal rules that apply when it comes to Israel's occupation of Palestine? So in the context of Israel-Palestine peace and U.S. policy, international law has historically not figured prominently. For example, after World War I, when President Woodrow Wilson recognized that Arabs in the Middle East were entitled to self-determination, as a matter of policy, the U.S. deprioritized Palestinian statehood and the national aspirations of Palestinian Arabs, and instead supported the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. And when in 1948, the U.S. actively supported the partition of Palestine into two states, one Arab and one Jewish, it did so against the wishes of 70% of the population who were Arab Palestinians, and despite the fact that only a slim majority of Jews lived in what was supposed to be the Jewish state, and it allocated 55% of the land area for the Jewish state. And while the U.S. recognized the right of Palestinian refugees who were forced out of their homes in 1948 in what became the State of Israel, three-quarters of Palestinian population had been displaced in what was known as the Nakba. The U.S. did not actively pursue the return of refugees as a matter of U.S. policy, nor did it work to ensure that the establishment of an Arab state followed the U.S. recognition of a State of Israel. And so the UN partition plan has been left on the table and somewhat discarded. But it wasn't until 1993 that international law was actually viewed as an obstacle to peace in US policy terms. This was when the series of agreements between Israel and the PLO were signed and known as the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords were viewed as a breakthrough by many at the time for a number of reasons. First, Israel had finally recognized that the Palestine Liberation Organization was the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Now, this was less of for the benefit of Palestinians than it was for Israel. If Israel didn't acknowledge the PLO's legal personality, then it could not expect the PLO and Palestinians to be bound by terms of any agreement. Second, the Oslo Accords set a definitive deadline for getting a comprehensive agreement on the contentious issues that needed to be resolved, including on refugees, Jerusalem status, settlements, and what the border would be. Third, the Oslo Accords also called for maintaining a status quo in the occupied territories. This would be during the negotiations, meaning there should be no settlement expansion and de facto annexation. And it stated that Gaza and the West Bank were one territorial unit. So while those were important achievements of the Oslo Accords, the Accords suffered from fatal flaws. Among them was that Oslo failed to identify the objective of negotiations. That seems crazy to us. Like, shouldn't an agreement identify what the purpose of the agreement is? But there was no mention of a Palestinian state being the goal. The other fatal problem with the Accords is that there was only one reference to international law, and it was to UN Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, which call for an end to Israel's occupation and mutual recognition between states involved in the 1967 war. Those resolutions do not explicitly mention establishment of a state of Palestine or the rights of Palestinians. In fact, the Oslo Accords do not mention that Palestinians have any legal rights at all vis-a-vis Israel. Why didn't Palestinians demand that international law be explicitly named as the terms of reference for negotiations in the Oslo Accords? If you ask the Palestinians who negotiated the Oslo Accords, they'll tell you that if they explicitly referenced international law, Israel would never have signed the agreements and would have never engaged in negotiations. To make up for this failing, though, they said that they relied on assurances from the U.S. that it would act as an honest broker to address the imbalance of power between Israel and the Palestinian people. The U.S. had become the sole superpower, remember, at that time, and it had a special relationship with Israel that it still has today. The Palestinian negotiators took the U.S.'s word on faith. Oslo's five-year deadline passed in 1999, and over the course of the last three decades of on and off again peace talks, Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem went from 240,000 to more than 750,000 today. Not only did the settler population mushroom under Oslo, but on every single one of the contentious issues that Palestinians and Israelis were supposed to come to an agreement on, known as the final status issues, which include a shared Jerusalem, the borders, the status of Palestinian refugees and settlements, the U.S. took it upon itself to resolve them in Israel's favor. For example, on Jerusalem, and when negotiations were at the height of their, you know, time, Congress under the Clinton administration called for the Holy City to remain Israel's undivided capital and for the U.S. embassy to be moved to from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is the U.S. embassy to Israel. Trump ultimately was the president to move that embassy in 2018, and the Biden administration has kept it in place. On borders, U.S. policy since the George W. Bush administration has been that the 1967 border is only a baseline, and that adjustments should be made to take into account certain demographic realities. So U.S. policy essentially became that the ever-growing blocks of Israeli settlements should be annexed to Israel under any peace deal. And on refugees, the Obama administration made it a prerequisite for peace negotiations that Palestinians recognize Israel as a Jewish state. This effectively meant that Palestinian refugees from 1948 would not be given the choice of whether to return to their homes and property inside Israel. This position was also legally problematic for Palestinian citizens of Israel. It opened the door 2 years later for Israel to pass the Jewish Nation State Law, which provided that only Jewish people have a right to self-determination in the area in which Israel considers it Israel. And in his Peace to Prosperity plan, President Trump reaffirmed the positions of all these previous administrations, but he went further by deciding that Israel was entitled to annex at least a third of the West Bank, and that not a single Palestinian refugee would return to Israel or resettle in the West Bank or Gaza. So considering the failure of the Oslo peace process and U.S. policy, Palestinians have tried to access legal mechanisms to advance their rights and claims. The U.S. has strongly opposed those efforts across Democrat or Republican administrations. So when Palestinians tried to make Palestine a full member of the UN to affirm the two-state solution and to be able to sit in bodies like the Security Council, the U.S. has opposed it. When Palestinians seek bilateral recognition from the remaining states in Western Europe that have yet to recognize Palestine, the U.S. uses its influence with the third states to prevent it. And when Palestinians go to the International Criminal Court to seek accountability for war crimes, or if the General Assembly seeks an advisory opinion, or third states seek a ruling from the International Court of Justice, the U.S. opposes it. Not only does the U.S. oppose Palestinian efforts or any effort toward Israeli accountability, it calls these efforts provocative unilateral actions, and it equates them with Israeli settlement construction. Now, why would recognition of Palestine as a state, which affirms the two-state solution, or seeking accountability for international crimes, be compared to settlement construction, which is actually illegal and a war crime, and is meant to destroy the two-state solution? The U.S. argues that they both prejudice negotiations. Now, that explanation is really hard to accept, given what I just explained about how U.S. administrations have bit by bit chipping at the final status positions of Palestinians on issues like Jerusalem, refugee rights, and settlements, etc. That certainly prejudices negotiations, but against Palestinians. Not only has U.S. policy prejudiced final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians, it infringes on international law, it legitimizes violations of Palestinian rights, and it destroys the possibility for a two-state solution. So, I've talked about why the law has been undermined by U.S. policy, but what does the law actually require? So the ICJ's recent advisory opinion of last month on Israel's prolonged occupation and its ruling in January on the case brought by South Africa under the Genocide Convention are instructive. In December 2022, the UN General Assembly asked the World Court, this is the judicial arm of the United Nations, for a legal opinion on what were or what are the legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and how does it affect the legal status of the occupation. Here are the points that are most important for us to understand about that opinion. Number one, it said that Gaza is occupied territory, and it's been occupied territories even after 2005, when Israel redeployed troops to the perimeter of Gaza while maintaining a siege and blockade over Palestinians there. It said that Israel's policies, its discriminatory practices, its Jewish settlements, its home demolitions, its two-tiered legal system, one for Palestinians and the other for Jewish settlers, amounts to annexation, it's illegal, and it's a crime of apartheid. It said that all settlers must be evacuated from the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and that Israel must withdraw from the occupied territories immediately. No negotiations, none of that talk about Israel's security. It needs to happen immediately. Now, it's up to the General Assembly to advise member states, international organizations, and the UN system on the obligations that flow from this World Court decision. But we should be under no illusions here. U.S. policy is unlikely to change because the ICJ opinion, which is advisory in nature, is not legally binding, even though it's a statement of law. The U.S. explained in its brief to the ICJ that it opposed the UN General Assembly seeking the legal advice of the World Court because it said doing so, quote, risks driving the parties further away from the objective of a two-state solution, unquote. It's important to recall that at the time the U.S. opposed the General Assembly's referral to the ICJ, Israel had just formed a new coalition government that included two ultra-nationalist racist politicians, one of whom had plans for the voluntary, quote, voluntary removal of Palestinians from the West Bank. And when the U.S. submitted its written brief to the court, the ICJ had found already that there was a plausible case of genocide taking place in Gaza. Now, it's hard to imagine how seeking enforcement of international law in fora such as the Security Council or the World Court makes matters more difficult between Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, I would argue that the best chance for a negotiated political solution lies in disincentivizing Israel's violations of international law by ensuring that there's accountability for Israeli violations. The U.S. also wrote in its brief that the only way to end the occupation is through bilateral negotiations that address Israel's security concerns. The problem with this position is that it gives Israel veto power to indefinitely maintain its occupation. In fact, in 2014, Secretary of State John Kerry expressed, quote, total confidence that Israel's security requirements could be met with a plan that he and General John Allen prepared at that time. Yet, Netanyahu refused to even consider the plan, demanding that Israel maintain overarching security control over the West Bank forever. Later, Kerry wrote in his memoir that it was clear, quote, Bibi was not interested in actually addressing the security questions in a way that could allow for the eventual withdrawal of the IDF, that's the Israeli army. He concluded, quote, this wasn't about security. And for 8 years, it still isn't about security. It's about colonizing the occupied territories and displacing Palestinians. And now, with regard to the case brought by South Africa at the ICJ, alleging Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza, the case on the merits has not been decided. But in January, the ICJ ruled that South Africa had made out a plausible case that genocide's taking place. The court's provisional measures ruling called on Israel to stop all killing of Palestinians without qualification. Arguably, you can't do that without a total ceasefire, though the court did not explicitly call for one. The court also said that Israel had to take immediate and effective measures to allow humanitarian assistance into Gaza to prevent starvation and death. Again, this is impossible to do without a total ceasefire. And finally, the court called on Israel to end its genocidal incitement. In light of the ICJ's ruling on provisional measures, the U.S. is obligated to stop its offensive weapons transfers to Israel. The U.S. is a signatory to the Genocide Convention and has accepted to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. Failing to stop the weapons transfers to Israel following that ICJ ruling could make the U.S. complicit in genocide. The U.S. has also recognized ICJ rulings on provisional measures cases are legally binding. It did so in the context of the case that was brought between Ukraine and Russia. However, there is no sign that the U.S. is considering to stop offensive weapons transfers, as you all probably know. In fact, the U.S. has accelerated deliveries and increased the amount of weapons to Israel above the $3.8 billion per year Israel receives. The EU and the UK are considering holding back weapons to Israel in light of the ICJ decision. If they take such a decision, it would put pressure on the U.S. to take some action as well to suspend weapons to Israel. Certainly, continuing to supply weapons to Israel while other countries institute an embargo would lend support for allegations that the U.S. is complicit in genocide. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
That was Zaha Hassan, writer, analyst on Palestinian affairs, human rights attorney, and fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Did you know that this program, Arab Voices, has been on the air since April 2002? That's over 22 years of weekly Arab Voices programming, over 1,000 programs covering different topics with more than 1,000 expert guests appearing on this show from around the globe. All of that has been possible because of your support to KPFT, Houston's community station, our community radio station. And it is time for the fund drive. Please call right now to support KPFT at 713-526-5738 and make a tax-deductible contribution or make it online at kpft.org. Every dollar counts. Think of the value you get out of KPFT and really for everyone who listens. We know that not everyone can contribute, but if you can and appreciate what KPFT brings you every day, please consider a pledge because KPFT relies on you, the listeners, for support. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.